Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Mind Illuminated, a complete meditation guide integrating Buddhist wisdom and brain science by Chula Dasa, John Yates, Ph.D., and Matthew Immergut, Ph.D., with Jeremy Graves, narrated by Sean Renett. Foreword. So, how does a neuroscientist end up as a meditation master? The two disciplines are different, to be sure. My training in brain science deals with neurons and synapses, while my study of meditation is concerned with matters of attention, introspective awareness, and investigating the nature of subjective experience. But in many ways, I've found that the two modes of understanding the world are more complementary than one might think, and they've given me a unique insight into how mindfulness actually changes the brain and our perceptions of the world around us. I've always been a seeker. For as long as I can remember, I've been fascinated by both the mind and the physical sciences. I always felt there must be a way to make sense of and unify our understanding of the world. What I sought, and what eventually crystallized into a lifelong passion, was nothing less than a search for ultimate truth. Little did I know what a long and convoluted but ultimately rewarding journey I would take to find it. I spent my teen years reading philosophy and psychology, Kant, Husserl, James, and Jung in particular. Despite the many insights they offered, it was disappointing to discover how little we knew about the mind, especially as compared to the precision and rapidly increasing depth of our knowledge of the physical world. So I then turned to religion, Christianity specifically, in the hope of finding answers. Inspired by the writings of John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, Meister Eckhart, and the anonymous author of The Cloud of Unknowing, I thought this might offer a path to my goal. After about 3 years of dedicated study and practice, I became a seminarian and was soon immersed in church history, philosophy, theology, and interpretive doctrines. But after another year and a half, I left, disillusioned at how unrepresentative the great mystics were of the modern church. Another dead end. However, I was not deterred in my search for truth. Since this happened during the mid-60s, I followed in the footsteps of a whole generation of seekers and turned to mind-altering chemicals and plant medicines for further exploration. Through my experiences with these, I gained, for the first time, some sense of what the early Christian mystics had spoken about. The search for truth seemed almost within my grasp. However, entheogens, as they are sometimes called, have their limitations. Mostly, I realized just how fluid our perceptions are and how much they depend upon neurochemical events in the brain, much more than on the data provided via our sense organs. Shortly after realizing this, I was introduced to Eastern religions with their promise of exactly the kind of truth I sought. Unfortunately, I couldn't afford to go to Asia like Ram Dass and others who had discovered both the virtues and limitations of mind-altering substances. But then the Beatles introduced Maharishi Mahesh Yogi and Transcendental Meditation to the West. This marked the true beginning of my meditation career. Not all of my exploration has been in the spiritual world. I've always had an interest in the so-called hard sciences, first sparked by my father, who was himself a research scientist with interests in everything from geology to astrophysics. By this time, I was a graduate student in physiology, the study of the mechanisms of the human body, and the idea of exploring the mind introspectively while at the same time studying its relationship to the brain was fascinating. These parallel explorations were to become my life's work. I spent 2 years practicing transcendental meditation, during which time I also completed my master's degree and began working on my Ph.D. When I discovered Buddhist meditation, the many pieces of my life so far began to fall perfectly into place. I'd come into possession of a sitar in need of repair, and I wanted to learn to play it. By chance, I met someone who could help me do both, and who had also spent several years studying Buddhism and meditating in Burma and Thailand. He was to become my first real spiritual teacher. Upasaka Kema Ananda had returned from Southeast Asia to teach others what he had learned, and had created a small residential community of students. Over the course of several weeks of sitar repair, as we carefully fit pieces together and waited for glue to dry, he gradually introduced me to the Buddha Dharma. He also encouraged me to attend one of the frequent weekend meditation retreats he offered. Everything he'd taught me so far sounded very appealing, but what clinched it was the day he told me the Buddha had said, "Don't take my word for anything I teach. Don't accept it on my authority. Come and see for yourself." Kema explained that everything the Buddha taught was available to anyone willing to take the time and train the mind to discover it for themselves. This sounded like science to me. I immediately asked to attend the next weekend retreat. I was soon part of a strong community of dedicated meditation practitioners with ready access to excellent teachers. This particular group represented a unique confluence of Tibetan and Theravadan teachings in the person of Namgyal Rinpoche, also known as George Dawson. Originally ordained as Ananda Bodhi, he was an acknowledged master in the Southeast Asian tradition before being recognized as the reincarnation of Namgyal by the 16th Gyalwa Karmapa, Rangjung Rigpe Dorje. My own teachers, Upasaka Kema Ananda and Jodhidhamma Bhikkhu, were his students. As Kema's student in this mixed lineage, I simultaneously engaged in the Tibetan Kagyu Foundation practices, Nundro, and the Theravadan Mahasi-style noting meditation practice. Meanwhile, I completed my PhD thesis, and my interests turned more and more to neurophysiology and cognitive psychology. It was the beginning of a hugely exciting era that continues to the present day, in which the neural circuitry of the brain is being mapped out in detail and correlated with various mind states, mental activities, and functions. However, throughout my postdoctoral fellowship years, I experienced a growing conflict between the kinds of animal experimentation required by laboratory research and the moral precepts that urged me to refrain from causing harm and suffering. In the end, I took the Upasaka vows of a dedicated lay practitioner, a sort of layman's version of monastic commitment, and ceased to be active in laboratory research. Instead, I dedicated myself to teaching neuroscience and studying the research of others, while at the same time engaging intensely in meditation and studying ancient wisdom texts from many traditions. The best description of the intervening years is to say they've been dedicated to studying the brain from the inside through meditation, and the mind from the outside through neuroscience and cognitive psychology. The confluence of meditation and neuroscience is a fascinating one, with the potential for each to greatly enhance the other. Both are, in fact, sciences, although meditation falls in the category of first-person science, which is only gradually gaining legitimacy among traditional scientists. In the science of meditation, the mind itself is the laboratory, and the various meditation practices and techniques constitute the experimental apparatuses that are utilized in this research. It is a science in the sense that it is objectively verifiable through repeated testing and replication of results. Everyone who accurately performs the same experiment in meditation reports the same results. And as with the physical sciences, meditation also generates technologies for change, profound changes in perception, worldview, mental states, and behavior. Through meditation, we begin to see and understand the fine structure and workings of the mind. The descriptions of the mind produced by meditators can then point out to a neuroscientist where and how best to apply various methods and technologies in their investigation of the brain. Likewise, the information about the brain revealed through science can guide us in our meditation practices, making them not only more effective, but also giving us new perspectives on what we experience in practice. One great example of this is the distinction I make in this book between attention and awareness. Despite hundreds of thousands of meditators practicing over millennia, it has never before been clearly conceptualized and articulated that the ordinary mind has two distinct ways of knowing, even though these different ways of knowing have so much to do with achieving the goals of meditation. However, cognitive psychology and neuroscience have recently shown that there are two distinctly different kinds of knowing that involve completely different parts of the brain. This is a finding that deeply informs new ways of practicing meditation and interpreting our meditation experiences from beginner to adept. This is only one example, but the point should be obvious. Meditation can guide and inform neuroscience, and neuroscience can do the same for meditation. A very clear pattern has emerged from our scientific explorations of the brain. Over and over again, we find there are neural correlates for mental activities. Although some will resist this statement, I believe we will eventually find that all mental phenomena, without exception, have their neural correlates. This has led many scientists to become staunch materialists, insisting that the mind is merely what matter does when organized to an appropriate degree of complexity. I am not one of them. Historically, the prevailing view in cultures throughout the world has been dualism, the idea that matter is one thing and the mind another. However, close examination renders this view untenable. As a result, two reductionist interpretations have always existed side by side with the dualistic view, each eliminating one side or the other of this dualism. Materialistic reductionism asserts there is only matter, and the mind is at best an emergent property of highly organized matter, and modern neuroscience is believed by many to support this view. On the other hand, meditation and other spiritual practices often make it clear that our subjectively experienced reality is mind-created, exactly the realization I had in my teens, although I arrived at it from a different route. This realization often draws people to some form of idealism, the other reductionist interpretation, which asserts there is only mind and that matter is an illusion, a mere projection of the mind to account for experience. For them, science is irrelevant to any search for ultimate truth. Obviously, I'm not one of those either. I am a non-dualist. Primarily as a result of meditation experiences, but supported by rational analysis as well, I hold strongly to this fourth alternative view. There is only one kind of stuff, and both mind and matter are mere appearances. When looked at from the outside, this stuff appears as matter, and as such has been the subject of scientific investigation. But when examined from the inside, this exact same stuff appears as mind. Non-duality, as realized through direct experience in meditation, completely resolves this dilemma. Both the implications and explanatory power of non-dualism are vast and would require at least another book to even scratch the surface. But thus, I say that I have spent my life investigating the mind from the outside through neuroscience and the brain from the inside through meditation. The core of my career as a dedicated lay practitioner has been a combination of daily study, practice, and numerous meditation retreats. This has been interspersed with several marriages, children, career moves, and all the ordinary distractions of a layman's life. The latter were as helpful as much as they were distractions, giving me plenty of opportunity to apply what I had learned by working through my own conditioning under challenging circumstances. I am especially blessed to have been present for this great intersection of the various Buddhist practice traditions, once so isolated from each other, as they have come together in the great melting pot of a developing global culture. I am equally blessed to have witnessed the tremendous advances in technology and research that are revealing the nature of physical reality, which includes unlocking the mysteries of the human brain. In particular, I feel deep appreciation and gratitude for the opportunity to bear witness to and participate in a process in which the cumulative wisdom of these Buddhist traditions rubs shoulders with Western scientific inquiry. This has all been part of my own personal journey, from despair to joy, and from ignorance to wisdom, for which I am incredibly grateful. This book is my offering to all truth seekers everywhere who are on their own special journeys. Introduction. My purpose in writing this book was to create a detailed and comprehensive meditation manual that is easy to use. Much has been written about the many benefits of meditation and its contributions to emotional, psychological, and social well-being. But there is surprisingly little information available on how the mind works and how to train it. This is an attempt to fill that conspicuous need. This book is appropriate for anyone with a strong interest in meditation, from a complete beginner to someone who has practiced for decades. It will be particularly useful for those who already have a practice and feel ready to go further on the contemplative path. It's also for people who are dissatisfied with their progress, despite years of meditation. This includes practitioners who feel they've actually benefited from meditation, but who have started to believe the more profound states of consciousness meditation offers are beyond their reach. Rest assured, the full rewards of meditation are closer than you think. By necessity, the material I cover is often quite detailed and nuanced, yet it is my sincere belief that anyone with motivation can succeed. And it doesn't have to take a long time. The whole training process is divided into 10 distinct, easy-to-identify stages, with thorough explanations and instructions presented along the way, from your first steps on the contemplative path, all the way to being an adept practitioner at the threshold of awakening. Meditation, the science and art of living. Meditation is a science, the systematic process of training the mind. It is the science of meditation that allows people from all walks of life to experience the same amazing benefit. A regular sitting practice has been shown to enhance concentration, lower blood pressure, and improve sleep. It is used to treat chronic pain, post-traumatic stress, anxiety, depression, and obsessive-compulsive disorders. Meditators develop valuable insights into their personality, behaviors, and relationships, making it easier to recognize and change past conditioning and counterproductive views that make life difficult. They have a greater awareness and sensitivity to others, which is enormously helpful at work and in personal relationships. The calming and relaxing effects of meditation also translate into increased emotional stability when confronting the inevitable stresses of life. Yet these are only incidental benefits. Fully developed meditation skills also give rise to unique and wonderful mental states characterized by physical comfort and pleasure, joy and happiness, deep satisfaction, and profound inner peace. States that can open the mind to an intuitive appreciation of our interconnectedness and dispel the illusion of separateness created by our egos. Furthermore, these fruits of meditation can be enjoyed all day long, for many days at a time, and we can renew them whenever we like, just by sitting down and practicing. I will describe these mental states in detail, and the systematic training presented here will lead to them with unfailing certainty. But even so, these peak experiences aren't the ultimate benefit of meditation. While bliss, joy, tranquility, and equanimity are delightful, they are also transitory and easily disrupted by sickness, aging, and difficult life circumstances. They also offer no protection from the corrupting influences of lust, greed, and aversion, nor their consequences. Therefore, these states are not an end in themselves, but only a means to a higher goal. That higher goal is awakening. Other commonly used terms include enlightenment, liberation, or self-realization. Each of these refers to a complete and lasting freedom from suffering, unaffected by aging, disease, or circumstance. True happiness, the bliss of perfect contentment, follows upon liberation from suffering. Awakening isn't some transient experience of unity and temporary dissolution of ego. It's the attainment of genuine wisdom, an enlightened understanding that comes from a profound realization and awakening to ultimate truth. This is a cognitive event that dispels ignorance through direct experience. Direct knowledge of the true nature of reality and the permanent liberation from suffering describes the only genuinely satisfactory goal of the spiritual path. A mind with this type of insight experiences life and death as a great adventure, with the clear purpose of manifesting love and compassion toward all beings. While this book is a kind of technical manual, it's also an artist's handbook. Meditation is the art of fully conscious living. What we make of our life, the sum total of thoughts, emotions, words, and actions that fill the brief interval between birth and death, is our one great creative masterpiece. The beauty and significance of a life well lived consists not in the works we leave behind or in what history has to say about us. It comes from the quality of conscious experience that infuses our every waking moment and from the impact we have on others. Know thyself is the advice of sages. To live life consciously and creatively as a work of art, we need to understand the raw material we have to work with. This is nothing other than the continuously unfolding stream of conscious experience that is our life. Whether we are awake or dreaming, this stream consists of sensations, thoughts, emotions, and the choices we make in response to them. That is our personal reality. The art and science of meditation helps us live a more fulfilling life because it gives us the tools we need to examine and work with our conscious experience. In other words, for your personal reality to be created purposefully rather than haphazardly, you must understand your mind. But the kind of understanding required isn't just intellectual, which is ineffective by itself. Like a naturalist studying an organism in its habitat, we need to develop an intuitive understanding of our mind. This only comes from direct observation and experience. For life to become a consciously created work of art and beauty, we must first realize our innate capacity to become a more fully conscious being. Then, through appropriately directed conscious activity, we can develop an intuitive understanding of the true nature of reality. It's only through this kind of insight that you can accomplish the highest purpose of meditative practice, awakening. This should be the goal of your practice. When life is lived in a fully conscious way, with wisdom, we can eventually overcome all harmful emotions and behavior. We won't experience greed, even in the face of lack, nor will we have ill will, even when confronted by aggression and hostility. When our speech and action come from a place of wisdom and compassion, they will always produce better results than when driven by greed and anger. All this is possible because true happiness comes from within, which means we can always find joy in both good times and bad. Although pain and pleasure are an inevitable part of human life, suffering and happiness are entirely optional. The choice is ours. A fully awake, fully conscious human being has the love, compassion, and energy to make change for the better whenever it's possible, the equanimity to accept what can't be changed, and the wisdom to know the difference. Therefore, make the aim of your meditation the cultivation of a mind capable of this type of awakening. This is the perspective from which this book is written. I sincerely hope it will be your perspective as well. There's so much myth and mystery surrounding awakening that many people tend to dismiss it. Rest assured, it's a goal within everyone's reach. The Buddha said that, with proper training, it should take no longer than 7 years, and can happen even more quickly. Here, You will learn all you need to know about what must be done, how to do it, and why. Think of this book as a traveler's guide, providing you with maps of the territory and detailed directions for getting where you want to go. A Modern Roadmap for Meditation. This book is the result of discovering how few long-time practitioners have ever experienced any of the more exalted states of meditation, much less the profound realizations that it offers. What I learned is that even after many years of trying, people weren't making the kind of progress they should have. The sincerity of their aspirations and the amount of time they spent practicing were definitely not the problem. What they lacked was a clear understanding of exactly which skills they needed to cultivate, in what order, and how to go about doing it. Put another way, what they needed but didn't have was a clear map of the process. It isn't that these kinds of roadmaps don't exist, because they certainly do, but they are largely inaccessible to most meditators. Some 2,500 years ago, the Buddha presented meditation training as a sequence of developmental stages in a series of verses known as the Anapanasati Sutta. Each verse describes one step in a progressive method for training the mind. Yet these verses are short on practical details and so cryptic as to be incomprehensible to any but the most experienced meditators. Perhaps there wasn't any need for the Buddha to go into specifics, because at the time there were many others who could interpret his words and provide clear instructions. Around 800 years later, the Indian monk Asanga identified 9 distinct stages in the process of developing concentration. 4 centuries after Asanga, another Indian monk named Kamalashila, who later taught in Tibet, elaborated on these stages of training in his 3-part Stages of Meditation, Bhavana Krama. Another invaluable source of information is the Path of Purification, Visuddhi Magga, compiled in the 5th century by the great Theravada commentator Buddhaghosa. As all these masters realized, teaching meditation by stages is an easy and effective way to help someone achieve the highest goals of the practice. Unfortunately, these and many other excellent maps of meditation lie buried in the commentarial literatures of different Buddhist traditions. Considering the volume and diversity of these commentaries, and that many of them have yet to be translated into European languages, it's no wonder the average Western meditator remains unaware of them. There is also the issue of interpretation. Few people, other than serious scholars, are able to cope with the obscure terminology and complex language of dense texts from a very different time and culture. However, traditional meditation teachings can't be properly understood without some experience of the kinds of mental states being described. Unless these scholars are also serious meditators, which is often not the case, their attempts at interpretation will always fall short. The modern roadmap offered in this book combines experience, tradition, and science. It's a synthesis based on first-hand experience and expanded on through the shared experiences of many other dedicated practitioners. To make sense of my own meditations and find guidance about where my practice should go next, I turned to my teachers, the Pali Suttas, and the commentaries of several different Buddhist traditions. Over and over, these traditional sources gave me the information I needed and provided an appropriate context to fit the pieces together. By integrating this information and my own experiences with the insights of psychology and cognitive neuroscience, I've reverse-engineered traditional meditation instructions to create a contemporary map of meditation. It's divided into 10 progressive stages to be used in charting your progress. While the structure of this presentation comes directly from traditional teachings, Asanga in particular, the meditation instructions that flesh it out do not. Also, this book is a fusion of teachings from different Buddhist traditions. While it is entirely consistent with all of them, it does not reflect any one tradition in particular. I believe this is one of its great advantages. It brings together the Indo-Tibetan Mahayana and traditional Theravada meditation teachings and shows how each fills in the gaps of the other. The techniques presented here apply to every kind of meditation practice. Keep in mind that all these source teachings were intended for monastics living in supportive communities of meditators. There wasn't much need to provide basic instructions and practical details, or to give examples. This isn't the case for modern lay practitioners. Most are practicing with little guidance, and often on their own. Therefore, while closely following these original teachings, I provide much more detail and give examples. I have also added an extra stage, establishing a practice, to Asanga's 9 stages to help people with jobs, families, and other responsibilities navigate the challenge of finding the time for meditation in their busy lives. These and other differences in this book reflect the differences between practicing as a householder and as a monastic. To help you progress as a householder, I offer you a clear map of the process that describes the whole journey, step by step. What needs to be accomplished at each stage, and how to do it, what things are better left until a later stage, and what pitfalls should be avoided. Otherwise, the contemplative path can seem like traveling from New York to LA with directions like turn right and turn left, but without a roadmap or a description of the terrain. Some people might make it eventually, but the majority would get lost. However, an accurate map will let you know where you're at and where you need to head next. It will also make the whole journey much quicker, easier, and more enjoyable. A book like this inevitably requires its own technical vocabulary. Some of these terms are influenced by Western psychology and cognitive sciences, and a few come from the ancient languages of India, Pali and Sanskrit. Many others are familiar words you're quite used to hearing, such as attention and awareness, but I will use them in a very specific way. Taking a little extra time to learn the meaning of these terms will be immensely helpful. It gives us a precise language to describe the practice and understand subtle experiences and states of mind. I define these key terms as simply and clearly as possible, emphasizing them each time they appear in a new context. Putting this practice into context. The meditation landscape in the West is a vibrant but confusing place. Tibetan practices emphasize elaborate visualizations or sophisticated analytical meditations, whereas Zen strips meditation down to the bare bones, giving you minimal instructions like just sit. Some Theravada teachers emphasize rigorously cultivating mindfulness to the exclusion of stable, focused attention, while others insist that intense concentration leading to deep, meditative absorption is best. Rather than argue for any specific technique, this book will help you make sense of all these different approaches without having to reject any of them. But to do this, I first need to clarify an important set of terms commonly found in meditation literature, showing how they relate to each other and the goal of awakening. These terms are shamatha, tranquility or calm abiding, vipassana, insight, samadhi, concentration or stable attention, and sati, mindfulness. Awakening from our habitual way of perceiving things requires a profound shift in our intuitive understanding of the nature of reality. Awakening is a cognitive event, the culminating insight in a series of very special insights called vipassana. This climax of the progress of insight only occurs when the mind is in a unique mental state called shamatha. Shamatha and vipassana are both generated using stable attention, samadhi, and mindfulness, sati. Although it's possible to cultivate either shamatha or vipassana independently of one another, both are necessary for awakening. Shamatha has 5 characteristics: effortlessly stable attention, samadhi, powerful mindfulness, sati, joy, tranquility, and equanimity. The complete state of shamatha results from working with stable attention and mindfulness until joy emerges. Joy then gradually matures into tranquility, and equanimity arises out of that tranquility. A mind in shamatha is the ideal instrument for achieving insight. Vipassana refers specifically to insight into the true nature of reality that radically transforms our understanding of ourselves and our relationship to the world. However, meditation also produces many other very useful, mundane insights, such as a better understanding of our own personality, social interactions, human behavior in general, and how the everyday world works. It can give us flashes of creative brilliance or intellectual epiphanies that solve problems or help us make new discoveries. These useful insights are not vipassana, however, because they neither transform us personally nor our understanding of reality in any profound way. The insights called vipassana are not intellectual. Rather, they are experientially based, deeply intuitive realizations that transcend and ultimately shatter our commonly held beliefs and understandings. The five most important of these are insights into impermanence, emptiness, the nature of suffering, the causal interdependence of all phenomena, and the illusion of the separate self, that is, no self. You can experience the first four of these insights using stable attention, samadhi, and mindfulness, sati, to investigate phenomena, dhamma vicaya, with persistence and energy, virya. The fifth insight into no self is the culminating insight that actually produces awakening, because only by overcoming our false, self-centered worldview can we realize our true nature. But this crucial insight requires, in addition to the first four insights, that the mind also be in a state of shamatha, filled with deep tranquility and equanimity. For both shamatha and vipassana, you need stable attention, samadhi, and mindfulness, sati. Unfortunately, many meditation traditions split samadhi and sati, linking concentration practice exclusively to shamatha and mindfulness practice exclusively to vipassana. This creates all sorts of problems and misunderstandings, such as emphasizing mindfulness at the expense of stable attention, or vice versa. Stable, hyper-focused attention without mindfulness leads only to a state of blissful dullness, a complete dead end. But just as stable attention without mindfulness is a dead end, the opposite is also true. You simply cannot develop mindfulness without stable attention. Until you have at least a moderate degree of stability, mindfulness practice will consist mostly of mind wandering, physical discomfort, drowsiness, and frustration. Like two wings of a bird, both stable attention and mindfulness are needed, and when they are cultivated together, the destination of this flight is shamatha and vipassana. Also, brief episodes of shamatha can occur long before you become an adept practitioner. Insight can happen at any time as well. This means a temporary convergence of shamatha and vipassana is possible and can lead to awakening at any stage. In this sense, awakening is somewhat unpredictable, almost like an accident. Although the possibility of awakening exists at any time, the probability increases steadily as you progress through the stages. Therefore, awakening is an accident, but continued practice will make you accident-prone. You're training your mind throughout the 10 stages, cultivating all the qualities of shamatha. As you progress, the mind inevitably becomes more and more fertile for the seeds of insight to ripen and blossom into awakening. The 10 stages provide a systematic process for developing stable attention and mindfulness together, in balance, with shamatha and vipassana as outcomes. The most accurate and useful description of this method is shamatha-vipassana meditation, or the practice of tranquility and insight. Again, the practice offered in this book doesn't have to be a replacement for other techniques, but instead can complement any other type of meditation you already do. You can use the 10 stages approach in combination with, or as a precursor to, any of the many Mahayana or Theravada practices. How to use this book. Here's a brief summary of the book's structure, so you have an idea where you're headed. It begins with an overview of all 10 stages and the 4 milestone achievements that mark your progress through the stages. Detailed chapters on each stage follow, with a series of interludes that come between the stages. The first interlude lays the groundwork for the practice. You'll be introduced to the model of conscious experience and learn about working with attention and peripheral awareness. The second interlude introduces you to the major hindrances and problems you will face in your practice. The third interlude builds on ideas you've learned so far to explain how mindfulness works. The fourth and fifth interludes introduce new, more in-depth models of mind, the moments of consciousness model and the mind system model. The sixth interlude lays the foundations for stages 7 through 10. The seventh interlude provides further refinements to the models of mind you've learned so far to help you fully understand subtle and profound meditative states. This book can be used in several ways. You can listen to the whole thing, or you can use it more as a reference guide, picking which chapters to hear based on the current state of your practice. Many will find the interludes of great help, but those less technically inclined may prefer to no more than lightly listen to the later interludes, just to give their practice some context. If you ever find yourself feeling adrift, uncertain about where the path is headed, the chapter to listen to again is An Overview of the 10 Stages. Together, the stages and interludes will lead you on a profound adventure of self-discovery and mental cultivation. If you take your time, studying the ideas and putting them into practice, you'll overcome psychological challenges, experience extraordinary states, and learn to use your mind with amazing proficiency. You'll discover an unprecedented inner calm and gain a deep understanding, even a direct experience, of ultimate truth. An Overview of the 10 Stages. The entire process of training the mind unfolds through 10 stages. Each stage has its own distinct characteristics, challenges to overcome, and specific techniques for working through those challenges. The stages mark gradual improvements in your abilities. As you make progress, there will also be 4 milestone achievements that divide the 10 stages into 4 distinct parts. These are especially significant transition points in your practice, where mastery of certain skills takes your meditation to a whole new level. The stages and milestones, considered together, form a broad map to help you figure out where you are and how best to continue. Yet because each person is unique, the route your spiritual journey takes will always be at least slightly different from that of somebody else. For this reason, we will also talk about how the process unfolds, how fast or slow you may experience progress, and what kind of attitude to have. The point isn't to force your experience to match something you have heard. Instead, use this book as a guide for working with and understanding your own experiences, no matter what forms they take. This chapter outlines the general arc of the practice, and the rest of the chapters provide the details. It will be helpful to revisit this chapter from time to time to keep the big picture fresh in your mind. The more clearly you understand the stages and why they happen in the order that they do, the quicker and more enjoyably you will walk the path toward happiness and freedom. How the process unfolds. Each of the 10 stages on the path to becoming an adept meditator is defined in terms of certain skills that you have to master. Only when you have mastered the skills of a particular stage will you be able to master the next stage. This is because your abilities as a meditator gradually build on each other. Just as you have to learn to walk before you can run, you must move through the stages in order, without skipping any of them. To make progress, you should correctly determine your current stage, work diligently with the techniques you're given, and move on only when you have achieved mastery. Mastery of one stage is a requirement for the mastery of the next, and none can be skipped. Taking shortcuts just creates problems and ultimately prolongs the process, so they're not really shortcuts. Diligence is all you need to make the fastest progress possible. However, even though the stages are presented as a linear path of progress, the practice doesn't actually unfold in such a straightforward manner. For example, a beginning meditator will be working on stages 1 and 2 at the same time. As your practice progresses, you will frequently find yourself navigating several stages at the same time, moving back and forth between them over weeks, days, or even during a single session. This is perfectly normal. You can also expect to have times when you seem to have jumped to a more advanced stage, as well as days when you seem to have gone backward. In every case, the important thing is to practice according to whatever is happening in your meditation in the present. Don't get ahead of what is actually happening. On the other hand, once you have overcome the obstacles for a given stage, even temporarily, then you can work with the obstacles for the next stage. You will also notice that many of the techniques are similar in several different stages. A meditator at stage 3, for instance, uses similar techniques as a meditator at stage 4. The same is true for stages 5 and 6. However, the goals for each stage are always different. The secret to progress is working with the specific obstacles and goals appropriate to your current skill level. It's like learning to skate. You have to learn the basics before you can start doing triple axels. The earlier stages take longer to master. However, because the stages build on one another, the methods overlap, and the skills you develop in one stage are used in the next, you start making faster and faster progress. Advancing from stage 3 to stage 4 might take a long time, but progressing from 4 to 5 usually happens more quickly, and so on. It's common to have occasional or even frequent meditation experiences that correspond to more advanced stages. Even a beginning meditator at stage 2 may have experiences that resemble those of advanced stages. When this happens, you might overestimate your abilities and try to replicate the experience instead of working to master the skills for your current stage. Such experiences have no real significance in terms of your progress, although they do show you what is possible. Use them as inspiration while continuing to work toward mastering your current stage. Isolated meditation experiences can happen at any time, but if they can't be repeated consistently and intentionally, they are of little value. Once your practice matures, you will have the knowledge and skills to consistently create these kinds of experiences. The rate of progress through the 10 stages. Some books give the impression that it takes many, many years or even decades to become an adept meditator. This simply isn't true. For householders who practice properly, it's possible to master the 10 stages within a few months or years. What you need is a regular daily sitting practice of 1 to 2 hours per day. Meditation retreats are quite helpful, but ones lasting months or years are certainly not necessary. Diligent daily meditation, combined with occasional longer periods of practice, will be enough for success. That said, there are several factors that determine how fast we make progress. Some of them we can influence, others we can't. To start with, different people have different natural abilities for working with attention and awareness. Some lifestyles and career paths are more conducive to developing these skills. Also, some people are better able to discipline themselves to practice regularly and diligently. Regardless of your natural abilities, you absolutely must master stage one, establishing a practice, to make progress. Life factors and stressful events can also affect the process. Losing your job, the death of a spouse, or a health problem can set even an advanced meditator back to the earliest stages. In fact, almost anything that happens outside of meditation can potentially have this effect. This just serves as another reminder that meditative accomplishments, like everything else, depend on certain conditions and can therefore be influenced by worldly events. Another factor that affects your progress is the problem of compartmentalization. We have a common tendency to separate meditation practice from the rest of our life. If the skills and insights we learn on the cushion don't infuse our daily life, progress will be quite slow. It's like filling a leaky bucket. This may be one reason why some people consider long retreats the only way to make real progress. Retreats are certainly wonderful and can help bring your practice to a whole new level. Yet we can only experience the full benefits if the wisdom we acquire permeates every facet of our life. And that takes work. Otherwise, long retreats are like filling an even bigger leaky bucket. The most important factor for improving quickly is a clear understanding of each stage. That means recognizing the mental faculties you need to cultivate, as well as the correct methods to overcome specific obstacles. It also means not getting ahead of yourself. Be systematic and practice at the appropriate level. Just as a scalpel is more effective for surgery than a large knife, skillful means and positive reinforcement are much better for pacifying the mind than blind, stubborn persistence. Finesse and patience pay off. The 10 stages of meditative training. Here, I briefly describe each stage's distinct characteristics, goals, challenges, and the techniques for achieving those goals and working through those challenges. Four particularly significant achievements divide the 10 stages into four distinct parts. 1 through 3 are the stages of a novice. 4 through 6 are the stages of a skilled meditator. 7 is a transition stage. And 8 through 10 are the stages of an adept. It is helpful to think of each stage in terms of the milestone that lies ahead. You will also notice a number of key terms. Don't worry if you don't know what the terms mean or can't remember everything being presented here. All of it is explained in greater detail in later chapters. The novice, stages 1 through 3. Stage 1, establishing a practice. This stage is about developing a consistent and diligent meditation practice. Being consistent means setting a clear daily schedule for when you're going to meditate and sticking to it, except when there are circumstances beyond your control. Diligence means engaging wholeheartedly in the practice rather than spending your time on the cushion, planning, or daydreaming. Goals: develop a regular meditation practice. Obstacles: resistance, procrastination, fatigue, impatience, boredom, lack of motivation. Skills: creating practice routines, setting specific practice goals, generating strong motivation, cultivating discipline and diligence. Mastery: never missing a daily practice session. Stage 2, interrupted attention and overcoming mind wandering. Stage 2 involves the simple practice of keeping your attention on the breath. This is easier said than done. You will discover that attention is easily captured by a distraction, making you forget that you're supposed to be paying attention to the breath. Forgetting quickly leads to mind wandering, which can last a few seconds, several minutes, or the entire meditation session. This sequence is so important it's worth committing to memory. The untrained mind produces distractions that lead to forgetting, which results in mind wandering. In stage 2, you only work with the last event, mind wandering. Goals: shorten the periods of mind wandering and extend the periods of sustained attention to the meditation object. Obstacles, mind wandering, monkey mind, and impatience. Skills, reinforcing spontaneous introspective awareness and learning to sustain attention on the meditation object. Spontaneous introspective awareness is the aha moment when you suddenly realize there's a disconnect between what you wanted to do, watch the breath, and what you're actually doing, thinking about something else. Appreciating this moment causes it to happen faster and faster, so the periods of mind wandering get shorter and shorter. Mastery. You can sustain attention on the meditation object for minutes, while most periods of mind wandering last only a few seconds. Stage 3. Extended attention and overcoming forgetting. Stages 2 and 3 are similar, but mind wandering gets shorter and shorter until it stops altogether. The biggest challenge during this stage is forgetting, but sleepiness often becomes a problem as well. Goals: overcome forgetting and falling asleep. Obstacles: distractions, forgetting, mind wandering, and sleepiness. Skills: use the techniques of following the breath and connecting to extend the periods of uninterrupted attention and become familiar with how forgetting happens. Cultivate introspective awareness through the practices of labeling and checking in. These techniques allow you to catch distractions before they lead to forgetting. Mastery: rarely forgetting the breath or falling asleep. Milestone 1. Continuous attention to the meditation object. The first milestone is continuous attention to the meditation object, which you achieve at the end of stage 3. Before this, you're a beginner, a person who meditates rather than a skilled meditator. When you reach this milestone, you're no longer a novice, prone to forgetting, mind wandering, or dozing off. By mastering stages 1 through 3, you have acquired the basic first-level skills on the way to stable attention. You can now do something that no ordinary, untrained person can. You will build on this initial skill set over the course of the next 3 stages to become a truly skilled meditator. The Skilled Meditator, stages 4 through 6. Stage 4. Continuous attention and overcoming gross distraction and strong dullness. You can stay focused on the breath more or less continuously, but attention still shifts rapidly back and forth between the breath and various distractions. Whenever a distraction becomes the primary focus of your attention, it pushes the meditation object into the background. This is called gross distraction. But when the mind grows calm, there tends to be another problem: strong dullness. To deal with both of these challenges, you develop continuous introspective awareness to alert you to their presence. Goal: overcome gross distraction and strong dullness. Obstacles, distractions, pain and discomfort, intellectual insights, emotionally charged visions and memories. Skills: developing continuous introspective awareness allows you to make corrections before subtle distractions become gross distractions, and before subtle dullness becomes strong dullness. Learning to work with pain, purifying the mind of past trauma and unwholesome conditioning. Mastery: gross distractions no longer push the breath into the background, and breath sensations don't fade or become distorted due to strong dullness. Stage 5. Overcoming subtle dullness and increasing mindfulness. You have overcome gross distractions and strong dullness, but there is a tendency to slip into stable, subtle dullness. This makes the breath sensations less vivid and causes peripheral awareness to fade. Unrecognized subtle dullness can lead you to overestimate your abilities and move on to the next stage prematurely, which leads to concentration with dullness. You will experience only a shallow facsimile of the later stages, and your practice will come to a dead end. To overcome subtle dullness, you must sharpen your faculties of attention and awareness. Goal: to overcome subtle dullness and increase the power of mindfulness. Obstacles: subtle dullness is difficult to recognize, creates an illusion of stable attention, and is seductively pleasant. Skills: cultivating even stronger and more continuous introspective awareness to detect and correct for subtle dullness. Learning a new body scanning technique to help you increase the power of your mindfulness. Mastery: you can sustain or even increase the power of your mindfulness during each meditation session. Stage 6. Subduing subtle distraction. Attention is fairly stable, but still alternates between the meditation object and subtle distractions in the background. You're now ready to bring your faculty of attention to a whole new level where subtle distractions fall away completely. You will achieve exclusive attention to the meditation object, also called single-pointed attention. Goal: to subdue subtle distractions and develop metacognitive introspective awareness. Obstacles: the tendency for attention to alternate to the continuous stream of distracting thoughts and other mental objects in peripheral awareness. Skills: defining your scope of attention more precisely than before, and ignoring everything outside that scope until subtle distractions fade away. Developing a much more refined and selective awareness of the mind itself, called metacognitive introspective awareness. You will also use a method called experiencing the whole body with the breath to further subdue potential distractions. Mastery: subtle distractions have almost entirely disappeared, and you have unwavering exclusive attention together with vivid mindfulness. Milestone 2: sustained exclusive focus of attention. With mastery of stages 4 through 6, your attention no longer alternates back and forth from the breath to distractions in the background. You can focus on the meditation object to the exclusion of everything else, and your scope of attention is also stable. Dullness has completely disappeared, and mindfulness takes the form of a powerful metacognitive introspective awareness. That is, you are now aware of your state of mind in every moment, even as you focus on the breath. You have accomplished the two major objectives of meditative training: stable attention and powerful mindfulness. With these abilities, you are now a skilled meditator and have achieved the second milestone. The transition. Stage 7. Stage 7: exclusive attention and unifying the mind. You can now investigate any object with however broad or narrow a focus you choose, but you have to stay vigilant and make a continuous effort to keep subtle distractions and subtle dullness at bay. Goal: effortlessly sustained exclusive attention and powerful mindfulness. Obstacles: distractions and dullness will return if you stop exerting effort. You must keep sustaining effort until exclusive attention and mindfulness become automatic. Then effort will no longer be necessary. Boredom, restlessness, and doubt tend to arise during this time. Also, bizarre sensations and involuntary body movements can distract you from your practice. Knowing when to drop all effort is the next obstacle. But making effort has become a habit, so it's hard to stop. Methods: practicing patiently and diligently will bring you to the threshold of effortlessness. It will get you past all the boredom and doubt, as well as the bizarre sensations and movements. Purposely relaxing your effort from time to time will let you know when effort and vigilance are no longer necessary. Then you can work on letting go of the need to be in control. Various insight and jhana practices add variety at this stage. Mastery: you can drop all effort, and the mind still maintains an unprecedented degree of stability and clarity. Milestone 3: effortless stability of attention. The third milestone is marked by effortlessly sustained exclusive attention, together with powerful mindfulness. This state is called mental pliancy and occurs because of the complete pacification of the discriminating mind, meaning mental chatter and discursive analysis have stopped. Different parts of the mind are no longer so resistant or preoccupied with other things, and diverse mental processes begin to coalesce around a single purpose. This unification of mind means that, rather than struggling against itself, the mind functions more as a coherent, harmonious whole. You have completed the transition from being a skilled meditator to an adept meditator. The Adept Meditator, Stages 8 through 10. Stage 8, Mental Pliancy and Pacifying the Senses. With mental pliancy, you can effortlessly sustain exclusive attention and mindfulness, but physical pain and discomfort still limit how long you can sit. The bizarre sensations and involuntary movements that began in Stage 7 not only continue, but may intensify. With continuing unification of mind and complete pacification of the senses, physical pliancy arises, and these problems disappear. Pacifying the senses doesn't imply going into some trance. It just means that the five physical senses, as well as the mind sense, temporarily grow quiet while you meditate. Goal: complete pacification of the senses and the full arising of meditative joy. Obstacles: the primary challenge is not to be distracted or distressed by the variety of extraordinary experiences during this stage. Unusual and often unpleasant sensations, involuntary movements, feelings of strong energy currents in the body, and intense joy. Simply let them be. Method: practicing effortless attention and introspective awareness will naturally lead to continued unification, pacification of the senses, and the arising of meditative joy. Jhana and other insight practices are very productive as part of this process. Mastery: when the eyes perceive only an inner light, the ears perceive only an inner sound, the body is suffused with a sense of pleasure and comfort, and your mental state is one of intense joy. With this mental and physical pliancy, you can sit for hours without dullness, distraction, or physical discomfort. Stage 9. Mental and physical pliancy and calming the intensity of meditative joy. With mental and physical pliancy comes meditative joy, a unique state of mind that brings great happiness and physical pleasure. Goal: the maturation of meditative joy, producing tranquility and equanimity. Obstacles: the intensity of meditative joy can perturb the mind, becoming a distraction.